Finding out I was going to become a dad was actually what made me finally bite the bullet, sit down and finish, devote all my time to finishing the book, because I knew that once I had a kid to take care of, that I was, probably going to have to get a full-time job and devote most of my time to that. So it seemed like the window for making my living as a writer was like closing.
Welcome to The Art of Fatherhood, a podcast that takes you on the journey of fatherhood. Now, here's your host, Art Eddy.
Hey, everyone. Art Eddy here for The Art of Fatherhood. And this week's episode is being brought to you by Semper Smart Games. And I'm very fortunate to be actually talking with Jim Morin, who started Semper Smart Games. A lot of great games that are educational. For my listeners out there, give a brief summary of Semper Smart Games and why people should pick them up, sir.
Well, we're a fairly young company, but a few years ago with my own kids, I kind of set out on a journey to teach critical skills and knowledge that kids have a hard time learning, but through active and engaging play. I started with my PlaySmart dice system with some fun games that teach math fact fluency, kind of mental math in a fun way that you can play for minutes at a time or over longer periods with your family around the table, on the go or wherever. And then we use kind of those dice that are uniquely numbered and emphasize better math operations that they than normal dice and operations that they struggle with in games like Election Night, where they're running for president and they have to learn about the Electoral College and have to make meaningful strategy decisions. Some other games, Math Tac-Toe, which is a multi-skill level game where you can have an addition card playing a multiplication card and some more advanced math operations going on, fun for the whole family.
And he creates so many fun games, different types of levels of games for all different types of families. Support this guy and support his family because he's doing really good things. But check more out at SemperSmartGames.com. What's going on, everybody? Art Eddy here for another edition of the Art of Fatherhood podcast. And I am so happy, fortunate, lucky. I'm geeking out as we speak because I have the one and only Ernest Klein chatting with me today. How you doing, Ernie?
I'm doing good, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man. Can't wait to talk about your book. Your new book, it's also into a new genre. It's the children's, like, young author edition. It's Bridge to Bat City. We're going to talk about that in a quick second. We're going to talk about a bunch of things. We're going to geek out together. But love bringing good guys like yourself to talk about your fatherhood journey. So when you found out you were going to be a dad, what was going through your mind, sir?
Oh, that I needed to finish the novel I'd been working on for 10 years, which was Ready Player One. My finding out I was going to become a dad was actually what made me finally bite the bullet, sit down and finish, devote all my time to finishing the book, because I knew that once I had a kid to take care of, that I was, probably going to have to get a full-time job and devote most of my time to that. So it seemed like the window for making my living as a writer was like closing rapidly. So I'm really actually grateful for that, that, my first, becoming a father motivated me career-wise to become a better provider, and that, changed my life. So,
no doubt.
I love panic was going through my mind.
But this makes me appreciate you and your work even more, because fatherhood inspired you to, like, all right, let's get this book out. And obviously with the success from it and, the movie and all that. So awesome that fatherhood, inspired you to finish the book. Talk about some of the core value. A lot of dads look at fatherhood differently, approach that, things differently, what they want to instill in their kids. But for you, man, I'm guessing like creativity and just kind of like being yourself are some of the values. But before I put any more words in your mouth, talk about some of the values you're looking to instill into them as they're growing.
I think that I have kind of a weird philosophy on parenthood and being a parent. That's maybe not the norm, but it is. That none of these kids asked to be brought here to planet Earth to enjoy the human experience, and you knew what you were getting them into. Like, they didn't know. Like, so it was kind of for your own. I always think of this for, like, because of your own psychological or biological needs that drive you to become a parent, or just accident. anything can lead you down that path, but usually if you decide to become a parent, like I did, then that's your choice that you're kind of imposing on the kid. So once the kid gets here, it's your job to make the experience of being here, as great for them as you can, as enjoyable and as painless. And the whole idea of like you have a kid and then when they turn 18, well, you're on your own. Like I did my best. Like I imagine that my kids are always gonna hopefully want my advice and my help, and I always plan to be there to take care of them, not just for the first 18 years or even the first few years. I just always feel like as a parent, you're obligated to your kids always because you're the reason that you brought them here to planet Earth. So it's part of your responsibility to help them deal with everything, including becoming parents themselves. It's still on your watch in my philosophy. So that's kind of like my core philosophy of being a dad is, you're there to not just as a protector and a provider, but also to share your worldview and your way of seeing the world and dealing with the world to help your kids prepare to have to deal with it themselves.
Such a great look on, fatherhood in the way. Yeah, it's like they weren't asked to be brought in there. You bring them in to the world. And just the idea of sharing things with them. That's a great way to look at parenting. So appreciate that, Ernie.
Yeah, thank you.
So you're a writer. You look at things. You create characters. You because just human interaction. You see this stuff. So I feel like you got this question already locked down. But talk a little bit about something that your kids have taught you about yourself or about life that maybe you didn't know was there until you became a dad.
Well, just not being the center of your own world anymore, I mean, that changed a little bit when I got married and I tried to put my spouse first, but even then, you're still you're part of a relationship, but you're still kind of your own person, and taking care of yourself is still your top priority and the thing that making things better for yourself. And then once you have a kid, that completely changes, and it's less about it became less about my goals and what I wanted to accomplish, and more about like how can I make things better for my kid. Those turned out to sometimes those overlap for me. Those overlap, like getting to do my dream job. I think made me a better dad, and gave me, the biggest blessing for me being a writer is that I work from home, and not having to, and when I'm at home and I'm my own boss, but when I'm done writing and it's time to pick the kids up from school, that's my writing window, is the time I drop the kids off at school and I go right back home, and then I work until it's time to go pick them up, and the day goes like that. I'm just because and then but once it's time to pick them up, then you have a limited amount of time before they go to bed. So I just try to make hanging out and being with them my focus, and it's my favorite part of being able to work from home, and that I don't have to deal with traffic and stuff before I get to hang out with them. So yeah, hopefully that answered your question.
No, yeah, I run my own business, obviously the site and podcast, and I love the fact that I'm able to, work from home, be there for them, like talk about their day. If they need to be picked up from a practice or whatever, I'm there for them. So yeah, I love that. Dad hack or piece of advice you'd offer to new dads, or just dads in general, parents in general, what would you offer to them?
Oh man. Maybe just to everybody, it's the thing. You can never people will warn you or tell you what it's like to become a parent, but you really have no idea until you get in there and do it yourself. And some people are naturals at it, and for some people it's more of a challenge, but I felt like I was a natural at it, and I'd always wanted to be a dad. And so I don't know. I think it's my only advice would be to make sure that you want to be a parent, and maybe spend some time around your nephews or cousins, to get a taste of what it's like, before you dive in. Because once you're in it, man, you dive right in head first, and you got to be in it all the way, and not just for 18 years, like for the long haul. So I don't know. Don't become and for I think for a lot of parents, it's like undoing the mistakes of their childhood or what they perceive to be, the things that their parents did that they didn't like so much. And that's always ever present in my mind. Like, what was it like being a kid, and did I like it? I think it's one of the reasons I think video games are such a huge, powerful thing for kids and powerful things for me, is because the rest of your life, you're being told what to do, like from the moment you get up to the moment you go to bed, like being told what to do, where to go, how to dress, like, and to get it together, you know. And you usually don't have any control or autonomy until you play a video game, and then suddenly you have total control and can do anything, you know, within the realm of the game. So that's a real, I think, powerful thing for kids. And playing video games with your kids also is a great, you know, is a great way. If you have a hard time playing with action figures, which I don't, you know, I can do that level of play, but real easy for me, because it's harkens back to my own childhood with Star Wars toys. But also playing video games with your kid, I think, is easier for some parents. But I love doing both those things.
Yeah, I so many great things right there. And the reoccurring thing you keep on saying is, like, it's not just until they're 18, like, you know, you just see them like kicking them out of the nest. I'm like, good luck. But like, right? The idea of just the, you know, being there for them and wanting them to come back is really great. And obviously you and I are both geeks, but you got on things. I remember when I interviewed Mark Hamill, he was like, the greatest thing is that my kids still want to like come out and hang out with me and my wife and all this other stuff, you know, their mom. And just the idea of being there and having these conversations, you want that there. And so for you to be like, yeah, you know, beyond 18, I still want to be with them and, you know, have them, you know, rely on me. I love that. And video games and action figures. I remember when I introduced my kids to the old Master of the Universe toys, we were playing with like Tinkerbell and like the Master of the Universe that are having these mashups. It was great. Video games are awesome too, because, you know, that's another way to bond. Like if you're playing Mario Kart, or my youngest and I started playing NHL, and now she's a Boston Bruins fan. So we get to go, you know, see the Bruins when they come to visit us and stuff like that. Like not visit, but like I live in North Carolina. So anytime they're playing the Hurricanes, every Christmas, I'm like, I'm getting tickets to, you know, for the Bruins and her and I to do that. So
it's so great.
Great, great thing right there, man. Another thing that you can do with your kids, bond with them, is read books with them. And obviously, Brit's a Bad City, this is cool. I love the fact that you ventured off into, you know, the children's book genre. Before we talk about the book, and there's a cool connection about how I came to be a fan of yours and Austin and all that. But before we kind of go into that, talk a little bit about, you know, what was your inspiration to go into the genre, sir?
It was really just this one story about the bats. And it when I first moved to Austin, I moved to Austin in November of 1996, and once kind of drawn by the allure of warm weather and this really cool, Austin seemed like the coolest town in the South. It was like a toss up between Austin and Athens, Georgia, were kind of similar college towns that have a really cool counterculture. And I think for Austin had a great independent filmmaking community, and Rick Linklater and Robert Rodriguez were down here, and it just seemed like the coolest. I was interested in getting into movies, but not necessarily making the leap to move right to Los Angeles. So Austin seemed like a half measure. And also I was working in computers, so I knew I could get a computer job down here. So that was all the stuff that led me to Austin. But then once I got here, one of the first things I had to go do was see the bats, because everybody would ask you when you told them you had just moved to town, like, oh, have you got to see the bats yet? And I'm like, no, but I guess I need to. And it was just the coolest thing I'd ever seen in a city, you know, is this giant invasive species that had moved under the bridge. And then once I heard the story, is that they were, when they initially moved in around 1982, they were going to burn them out with flamethrowers and blowtorches, and then put up screens so they could not get back in, because people were initially terrified because they had this preconceived notion about bats because of horror movies. There was actually like a cultural stigma against bats more than any other animal, because of, you know, everything from Scooby-Doo to, you know, old Lon Chaney movies. You grew up kind of being afraid from bats. Bats are creepy things. So the citizens of Austin had that reaction initially, and were like, we don't want these things living a mile from the Capitol building in the middle of downtown. But because it's Austin, and it kind of like the capital of weird in the whole world, within a space of just a few years, about 7 or 8 years, they went from being this invasive species to becoming the town mascot. And they named our ice hockey team the local Austin Ice Bats, and it became one of the biggest tourist attractions for Austin too, bringing in millions of dollars. So this as soon as I heard that story, and after seeing the bats, I'm like, oh, this is the greatest story ever for a kid. You know, if you love stories like Charlotte's Web or James the Giant Peach, or Fantastic Mr. Fox, stories about anthropomorphized animals going on an adventure, I'm like, well, this is the coolest. This is a real story about animals who moved into a city and were not welcome, but then, made themselves welcome, partly because they eat like their own body weight in insects every night. So it's really good for gardeners and farmers, and they eat all these crop pests, but also for a city full of outdoor music venues, the live music capital of the world, having these bats come in and eat up all the bugs every night was like the most perfect thing. It just made the city an even cooler place to live. So that story always stuck with me. And I'm like, man, someday somebody's going to do a story about those bats, and how they moved under the bridge, and it could be a Pixar movie, and it's going to be great. And I, years, like, man, 20 years went by of just that idea kicking around in my head. And it wasn't really, I think, until the pandemic, when my second child was born, and they were like a couple 3 years old when the pandemic started. So I got a full on dose of toddler time there for a couple of years, and reading a ton of books and rereading Charlotte's Web and James and the Giant Peach and all these old books that I grew up loving. And that made me think about this bat story. And I'm like, I could do this. And it's not science fiction what I'm known for, but the story, since you've read it, the story I ended up crafting is science fiction. That's the secret that people will discover when they read the book, is the kind of the inciting incident, and the whole story is about this little girl who has a flying saucer sighting and missing time one night, and then after that she's able to communicate telepathically with the bats. And so you never know if she's really communicating telepathically with the bats, or is she making it all up? She's kind of could be an unreliable narrator. And she kind of spells it out at the beginning of the story that it's a mostly true tall tale. So yeah. There's a certain amounts of it that are embellished, but and the mostly true parts of it is the story of the bats coming to Austin. And and so I kind of took eight, nine years of events that happened, from the bats moving in to the bats getting accepted, and kind of combined it all down, amalgamated it all into one summer. So it all, a whole decade's worth of stuff kind of happens in one summer. So it is a tall tale, but the core elements of it are true. And all the musicians that make cameos in the story were all, really people who performed here, but they didn't perform here maybe all on the same night.
Yeah.
I don't know if Muddy Waters and Steve Ray Vaughan were playing on the same night, but there were nights like that in Austin when you would go, you would be amazed at all the different, musicians, famous musicians playing in town for no money, for $5-6, you could go see amazing people. So Austin seemed like the perfect kind of, the capital of weird and the live music capital of the world, and a great, just a great setting for a kid's story. So, and I would, when I took my kids to see the bats, they would always ask, how did they get here? Why did they move here? And why did they, why is this the one place in the world that is the largest urban bat colony in the world? And nobody really knows the real reason why those bats moved in. Some people think there was a lot of old buildings being demolished downtown and they were living there, but I created this story about them losing their cave habitat at the same time this little girl and her uncle lose their family farm. And so they're both become homeless the same time as the bats and have to find a new home. And since they've grown up watching Austin City Limits, and everybody kind of, if you grow up weird in Texas in a little town, like Austin is the holy land. It's
yeah,
like it's the
Mecca. Yeah. Yeah.
Mecca. Right. I always think of Luke Skywalker. I think if you grew up in a small town in Texas, all these kids feel like Luke Skywalker, out there staring at the binary sun and dreaming of, moving to Austin, the state capital, which either for college and or to start a rock band or all of it. So often Austin is kind of this mythical place. And since then, it's become kind of world known for being this, epicenter of the counterculture, like a weird little, they call it the blueberry and the tomato soup down here. It's the one liberal, like forward-thinking city in the rest of Texas. So I love Texas, and I love Austin especially for its just uniqueness and the way it kind of goes against the grain. So all those things combined together to make me want to finally write this story. If no one else is going to do it, then I will do it. And I had a clear vision of how, James the Giant Peach was probably my favorite book when I was a kid. I would check that sucker out over and over again from the library, a big orange edition. I remember with a peach embossed on the front of it. And just the that book actually was a big inspiration on Ready Player One too. The very first page of James and the Giant Peach, his parents get eaten by a rhinoceros that's escaped from the zoo right in front of him. He like has this horrible traumatic thing happen to him in the first paragraph. His parents die and he sees it. And then he has to go live with his evil Aunt Spiker and Aunt Sponge. And that's so that's why Wade has to go live with his mean aunt in Ready
Yeah,
Player One, is because that was
nice.
what. So and Roald Dahl, James the Giant Peach, Willy Wonka had a big inspiration on Ready Player One too. So Roald Dahl's books had a big inspiration on me writing Bridge to Bat City as well. So lots of inspirations.
Yeah, man, I love that. And you should open up a store in Austin, like a Tosche station, so all the weird kids that want to be like Luke Skywalker can finally get their power converters when they're just chilling in Austin, man.
Yeah, that would be good.
I gotta give a shout out to my friend Patrick Quinn. He lives in Austin, and he's the one that like years ago was like, "Hey man, you gotta check this. You know, you gotta check this guy out." I was like, "All right, cool." He's like, he even like wanted my nerd card. He's like, "You haven't read Ready Player One?" I was like, "No." He's like, "You're an idiot." I'm like, "All right." Then I read it. I'm like,
Oh
"Yep."
man.
I'm like, "Thank you, man." And he actually got me. He because he lives in Austin. You were doing a book signing. He actually got me a signing of your book, and I was just like,
Oh,
"Dude, it's awesome." So big out.
awesome.
Shout out to him for introducing me to your work and also getting an autographed copy of it. But when I first went to visit him in Austin, he's like, "Dude, we got to check out the Bad Branch." I was like, "What?" But it's just cool. I mean, as a writer and someone like, you know, kind of geeking out, like when I had this opportunity, when your team reached out, I'm like, "Hey, you want an interview?" I'm like, "Heck yeah, I do." And then I was learning more about the book. I'm like, "This is freaking amazing for me." It's like a geek like circle is complete type of moment. I just wanted
Yeah.
to share that with you, man.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, I'll tell you something else crazy. The coincidence is the book is coming out on April 9th, and we're going to do the book launch here in Austin at the bridge, at the Real Brat Bridge on April 8th. And that's the same day as the solar eclipse,
Oh,
here in
nice.
Austin. So there's going to be a ton of people in town, I think, already coming to see the bats. So I'm really excited. But yeah, I think it's going to be a really cool thing for kids because usually when you read a story, the stuff in it is not real, you know, and often doesn't take place even in a real place. But this all takes place in a real, you know, in a real town, and the bats are real and they're still really here. And after kids read this book, you know, they'll be able to come and see the bats. I think it'll be a really cool, you know, not just for local kids, but millions of people come every year
Yeah.
to Austin for different things, South by Southwest or whatever. And I think this will be a cool kind of cultural thing. Again, it was James and the Giant Peach. I remember at the end of James and the Giant Peach, all that's left of the peach is the giant peach pit, and he makes it into a little house, I think, in Central Park is where the peach comes to rest. And then James moves in there and lives in the peach pit, and then other kids can come to visit him, and who've heard his story. And I always loved that idea of like, oh, what if there was a real place, you know, after you read this book and you could actually go and visit it. And that's what I love about this idea of Bridge to Bat City. It's a real, you know, Austin's a real place, you can really come here and see all kinds of music from all over the world and have all the best tacos and barbecue and meet the weirdest people. You would think that like this is the most, these cars driving these cars around Austin, it doesn't make a dent at all, right? It's all like, oh, some guy's got an R2 unit on the back of his DeLorean. Or they just know that it's me. Like, it's just one other, you know, these are just two more crazy art cars. In Austin, it's full of people with, you know, there's one guy who has Star Wars action figures diorama all over the outside of his car with AT-ATs and stuff. Just
Nice.
awesome. It's that kind of town, you know, whatever your weird sensibilities are, it's very accepting. And that's like a huge thing for kids. I think something to. It's important to present to kids early on. It took me, I think, into my 20s to become at peace with being a geek and being into a cinephile. And partly it's coming to Austin and realizing, oh, there's other people like me who are super obsessive about the things that they love and love to celebrate them with other people who love that stuff. And so that's a culture and a way of seeing the world that I wanted to present in my story and present to my own kids, is that, you know, not everybody needs to be what you're into, what you're into, you know,
Yeah.
but nobody should ever have the right to like put you down for what you're excited about. Like, never, It's in the book, never yuck anybody else's yum. Like if somebody else likes something and oh, how could you like that? Like anybody, any sentiment that's like, oh, how could you like that? How could you enjoy that? Like that's just an awful. Well, it's so much of the internet, right? Oh, you like that? Oh, you're an idiot for liking that or enjoying that or deriving pleasure from that. Like, is that a good force in the universe, that whole attitude? Or is it the opposite? Like, well, yeah, and that's the other advice to give to writers, right? Like, I didn't get where I am by, having that attitude of like, you enjoy that. I have got where I am by having the opposite attitude, like, oh, you love that? Oh, I love that too. Like, how about this? Like, the attitude of like, isn't that awesome? And here's something else awesome that you might enjoy, as opposed to, that's my enemy in the world is that attitude. The,
Totally
you know,
agree.
oh, you enjoy that? Yeah, I enjoy it. Like, do you enjoy anything?
Yeah, the idea that
I'm guessing.
you'd make an effort to go tell people what you don't like about something, and I like that phrase, like, don't yuck my yum, but it's just like the idea of like, well, what do you like? And it's okay. Like, it's to me, it's just I don't get it. I know that, bad press gets more publicity than good press sometimes. You're just like, what's going on? So I get that. And also too, from this book, just talking to you too about the bats and the idea of like, oh, they're looking at it as a bad thing. And the idea of like, the old adage, don't judge a book by its cover, right? But the idea of kids being more accepting than adults when it comes to like new people or new things or new experiences, right? Like, you want to soak that in. I kind of took, that was one of the themes I took away. And like, when you mentioned, James and Giant Peach and Charlotte's Web, I'm like, yeah, I got that too. And just the idea of the main character and just how she was looking at life and like what was how she was experiencing things, I was like, this is such a great way to teach kids and more importantly adults about the idea of just because you think something is bad, like investigate it first, see what the results are. And you mentioned a plethora of all of these different things that the bats do to make Austin better, right? So like, what do you hope people, kids and parents will have discussions or themes or take away from this book after they're done reading it?
Well, I think the big theme is just it's a like the theme of acceptance and finding. For me, it's a story about weirdos finding their place in the world. Like, whatever your weird sensibilities are, and whatever the things you're interested into, you're not alone. There's somebody else who feels that way too. Probably a bunch of people. And the trick is finding them. That's the best thing about the internet. For me, especially the early days, it like created the this network of that you could use to find other people who loved what you loved. If it was Buckaroo Banzai or Doctor Who or Ghostbusters or Harry Potter, whatever it is, like you could go find a website and a forum and a community where it's all the super fans of that. I love the RPF, which is a replica prop forum where these guys are all like into making replicas of cool stuff for movies, like my Futaba remote control that Dr. Brown has. Even do I have it? Yes, the lights off.
Oh, nice. I love it.
this is screen accurate, by the way. It's even got the little nine
Course it
volt.
would be.
But right, like I've got Marty's clock radio,
Already, I
right?
know you're looking at the details, making sure. Yep, that's
Yeah.
the
Right. That's what I love. People who get like bring joy from all that. That's what I'm doing with this car. So this was a Star Wars DeLorean before the Mandalorian came out. Like I had already put the R2 unit on, and but the Mandalorian had not launched. And then, oh my God, I'm a huge fan of that show. And then I started seeing people cosplaying as the Mandalorian, like people in Mando armor, but with like DeLorean like time circuits on their wrists. And I was like, but oh, I could make this into the Mandalorian. The Mandalorian, DeLorean. So that's what I'm in the process of doing. I'm trying to redo the whole inside to make it look like the Razor Crest, but it's a
awesome.
work in
You heard of
progress.
Elf on the Shelf, but let me introduce you to
Yes.
right? Awesome, man. Talk a little about a couple more questions before we finish off with the Father Quick
Sure.
Five. And again, I really appreciate you being generous with your time.
Oh.
Ready Player One, Two, and obviously Armada, some of my favorite books, geek to geek out to. I know you know, I love getting lost in your books, and it's just something like I, you know, when I was reading Armada, especially, like I just thought about me and my dad watching The Last Starfighter, and I just thought like certain things were like, oh man, this was giving me chills, and like even reading it, I was like, oh, I could see this happening at my school, and all of these different things, man. And I just, you're such a great writer, and I know that especially you're talking now about like learning that today about how ready, like being a dad, you know, kind of like, all right, let's go. This is the catalyst for me to, you know, finish this book. Is it, and I've written a book before with one of my, with a co-author John Finkel about fatherhood, but like, I know how tough writing a book is, but for you, is it more fun or is like, cause you go to work, you got to make sure you're writing all that stuff. But like when you're writing these books, is it, and obviously with Bridge the Bad City, is it more fun than it seems like work or what is it like for you?
Well, this book was a lot of fun. I think this was maybe the most fun I ever had writing a book, just because I was doing it for myself, and the stakes were very low. Like, I mean, this Ready Player One was my first novel, and it took me years, you know, and I was working full-time jobs at computer, in IT and at a computer all day. So I'd have to be at a computer all day and then go home and in the evenings and on the weekends and try to make myself get back in front of a computer and work on this book, you know, and never had enough time. That's why it took me so long, you know, until it was actually my first screenplay getting sold for Fanboys that gave me enough money to like live off that screenplay money while I try to finish this novel I've been writing forever. But the experience of that, and then everything you could ever want to happen when you write your first novel started to happen to me, you know, with Ready Player One, like beyond my wildest dreams that I never thought it would become a bestseller. Yeah, I wasn't even sure I would be able to sell it. I wasn't sure you could write a book like that without getting sued. I'm like, are all these people, can they sue me? Like, can I do this? You know, Dungeons and Dragons almost did sue me, I found out. I got invited to go to Wizards of the Coast on a tour, and they were letting me tour the whole place. And I remember going to the legal department at Dungeons and Dragons, and I made a joke. I'm like, oh, thank you guys for not suing me. And the guy paused. He's like, well, we thought about it. the whole Tomb of Horrors thing going into the Tomb of Horrors. I mean, I didn't create that. Gary Gygax created that. And then TSR and now Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro own the. But I think, you know, by putting the Tomb of Horrors in Ready Player One, I probably helped them sell one or two copies of the Tomb of Horrors. So I think they realized that. But again, I wasn't even sure you could, you know, fictitious use is like a fine line. I don't think anybody ever tried to write a novel like that, incorporating kind of all of pop culture into one virtual world. So after that and the unexpected success of Ready Player One, my second novel suddenly became a lot of pressure, you know, to do the same thing again, but different. And then the movie, of Ready Player One got made, and that made writing Ready Player Two in the wake of having Steven Spielberg adapt the first one, that also made the stakes really high, you know. So we worked really hard on both Armada and Ready Player Two. Is probably the hardest I've ever worked on anything, you know, because I was so grateful to people who were fans of the first book and the movie, and I didn't want to disappoint anybody. You know, that's the other like hard won piece of wisdom I've come to as a writer is you don't want to please everybody. Yeah. Like there are some people out there, you want to make them angry. You want to piss them off and you want them to walk away with a bad feeling. Like there's lots of those people out there. Like, I don't want you to enjoy my book. I want it to piss you off and I want you to throw it in the garbage and walk away angry for the rest of your life. That like, you know, cause I disagree with you and your ideas, your philosophy and your whole, you like that? Like if you're that kind of, you get enjoyment from that. Like if you're that kind of person, I really hope like my books turn your stomach and make you just and what it is, it's not so much that people dislike my books because they don't have to read them, right? What they dislike is that so many other people like them. Like just the whole, oh my God, like that's what people like. Again, that whole attitude of, oh, that's what people want. Yeah. Like I'm not being showered with adulation. They want that garbage.
You can write a better book than him.
But him, but this nerd, the kind of nerd I used to shove in lockers, now he owns two DeLoreans and Steven Spielberg's making his movie. Like I get it, it like fills you with anger and so, but yeah, that was hard because I used to want to please everybody, but now You know, I think just about as much about the people that I want to upset as I do the people, you know, I don't have to worry about the people who are going to enjoy it because I know they're going to enjoy it anyhow. You know, because that's the kind of people that they are. They sit down for a story to enjoy it, not to like pick it apart and like, oh, what can I find wrong with this? So yeah, I don't know. I went off on many
No,
tangents there.
you were great. I appreciate that. One more question before we finish off with the Father Quick Five. So, you mentioned fanboys. I know you're not, you're a stranger to writing screenplays and all that. But, and again, almost like I hear people like, oh, this wasn't like the book, like the, Ready Player One, the movie. For you, and working with Spielberg and just the whole team and all that, like, how hard was it to kind of condense and change things around to make it movie compatible, right? Like, we all know when you're trying to, like MacGyver things, like, all right, I have to like take this out so I can get this in there and all this other things, whatever you're doing. How tough was that?
Well, I'm a huge fan of movies and cinema, and film adaptations of books. Like
Okay.
I've seen, you know, lots of my favorite books adapted into movies that were very different, like Dune, the David Lynch's Dune, the first Dune, where he invented weirding modules and things that were not in the book but were cool as hell visually for the movie, and that I loved. And so I just knew from being a movie fan that when you convert a book into a pour a book into the mold of a movie, you're going to lose a lot. Like if let's Ready Player One, if you read that audiobook out loud, like Wil Wheaton did, it's like 14 hours long. And the movie is like 2 hours, 22 minutes, about. But then a picture's worth a thousand words, right? So, and that's 24 pictures per second, 24, in a film. So you can, convert a lot of the information and storytelling that's in the book into the movie, but it's got to be visualized. You can't just have a voiceover, you know, of reading the whole book. I mean, this is how I think the gold standard for book to film adaptations has got to be Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy, right? Oscar nominated for and Lord of the Rings considered the best. One of the best, greatest books of the 20th century. So, and there are people who hate those movies, and they even talk about it on the commentary. Crimes against the books. This is another crime against the books for anybody who's listening. Like Philippa Boyens and Fran Walsh and Peter Jackson would always like, here's another crime against the books of something we had to change. But I still love those movies, and I bet they got so many people to read the books who are like, oh my God, this world is amazing. I want more of this. And then they went and explored the world of the books and probably enjoyed it more. But that's, you know, books and movies have to be different. They're two different mediums, and they have completely different needs, a completely different time frame in which to tell the story, and it's a completely different tool set. So for me, that was all excited. But like, I don't know where this thing came from of people like reading a book. And then they go sit down at the movie adaptation, like they've got a checklist, like, all right, it better be exactly the same. Like, when has that ever happened? Once.
They've got like a little lamp
This was
on
not in the
and a
book.
notebook, right?
Yes. There was no race in the book. Like, no, this is different. Like, you're getting a whole new different experience. This is the movie, you know, version of that world, which that's always so much fun to see realized. Like, people choose to pick it apart, like. You already had the experience of reading the book. Like, why do you want to have that experience again? You know, and you already all imagined it in your own head. Like, why now it's Hollywood's going to imagine it all for you? I don't know. I have a different way of viewing that. But for me, that was the most fun experience I've ever had, is getting to like reimagine my story for the movies with one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, who, you know, inspired me to want to make movies. It was just the most fun ever, and I was really, you know, it didn't matter to me whether or not the movie did well. I'm like, this is the greatest time ever. Like, I hope people like it, but if they don't, it doesn't matter. I'm still having a blast, and this is an amazing experience that I'm gonna treasure forever. But I was luckily enough, people did like the movie, and now it's like getting ripped off for Apple Vision Pro commercials. Did you see that? Did you see the Apple Vision Pro literally stole a shot from the movie? Everybody's like, did they know that it was a dystopia? Did they know that? But I love that. I think they a lot of thought went into Apple Vision Pro and making it both look like Wade's headset, the blue stuff across the front. That's not existed anywhere else in virtual reality.
Yeah.
So that, but also even the name Apple Vision Pro is the same syllable count as Ready Player One. Ready Player One, Apple Vision Pro. Two
Oh.
syllables. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I think
Life
there's more to
imitates
it.
art and art imitates life, right?
Right? It's true.
And Ernie, also too, the idea that you're putting logic in making when a book is made into a movie, stop doing that. We can't use logic and reason. Come on, man.
No, it's yeah. No, it's yeah, it's out of fashion, but I'm still doing it.
Well, I really appreciate your insight on that and just your views on that. It was really cool. Now we're gonna finish off the Father Quick Five. Favorite family movie? It doesn't have to be a movie, it can be a show, whatever. Do you guys have one?
Well, my I have a 5-year-old and a 16-year-old, and so we like Studio Ghibli movies a lot.
Okay.
Probably the younger one, My Neighbor Totoro.
Yeah.
Totoro is one of our favorites. I love all of Miyazaki, but some Miyazaki is kind of dark. So I would say, and then my eldest, we really bonded over 80s movies. They were really big into Stranger Things. And a movie that I exposed them to that is a secret Amblin movie. Nobody knows that it was made by Amblin. 3 o'clock High. You ever see 3 o'clock High? Yeah, we're gonna fight the kid after school. Casey Simasco. Oh, we love that movie, and my kid and I are quote that all the time. You don't get it, Jerry. You and me are gonna fight after school. But I found out from listening to the commentary track of 3 o'clock High that Steven Spielberg produced that. Like they didn't do it under the Amblin banner, but it was still Amblin producing it for some legal reason. That's like a secret Amblin movie, 3 o'clock High.
Nice.
So. A
Very
good
cool.
family.
Yeah. A cool Easter egg, if you will, learn it this night.
Yeah.
Also, too, like for one movie I haven't shown my kids yet, but like I want to show it to them from like the 80s was The Monster Squad. Like, I
Oh, so
such a good
great.
one.
I got here where you can, show you. I got big Last Starfighter fan, so I got Last Starfighter.
Oh, nice. Well done, sir. That's awesome.
And that's the up here is the map from Time Bandits.
Nice.
Return the map. So those are two of my other favorite kids movies. Obviously Last Starfighter, a big influence on me, and Time Bandits. Oh my gosh, used to watch Time Bandits over and over and over again. So
Genre of maybe 80s, but genre of music you couldn't wait to introduce your kids to.
man, genre of music, they might be Giants. I was super
Oh,
excited
nice.
to introduce
Okay.
my kid to They Might Be Giants, just because I
Yeah.
love that song, those songs. And then they started making kids music exclusively once they had their own kids, and so that would be my answer.
Nice.
TMBG, love those guys.
Well done. Describe the perfect family vacation. Where would it be?
Oh man, it'd actually probably be at home. We like to have like all our the cousins come over, and we're a big video game family, so our favorite vacation would be no school and everybody comes over and we play lots of video games until the sun comes up.
Awesome, man. And you just showed me a bunch of cool collectibles and all that. Is there one that is like, I'm a geek collector, but I'm also a sneakerhead and always say, like, is there a Chasing Amy pair that you're still trying to find? So for you, do you have like one that like you're on the hunt for?
As man, not really.
I could imagine that'd be like, yeah, I really don't
I
have
have
just because like you got all the
managed
good
to
stuff right now.
one I do. Well, I will show you. Maybe somebody out there can help me. But back here in this car, this computer is an old police computer. The mobile data terminal 9100. This is not actually from a movie or anything. I just love the Fallout like design look of it.
Yeah.
And this is actually a 386 computer in here, and this one does not work. But I'm trying to find a working version of this MDT 9100 that's a 386, so I could run like Ghostbusters billing software and stuff on it. But that's one thing I'm looking for. It's hard to
Sir,
find.
you
Anybody
are
knows
awesome. You
anybody
are
out,
awesome.
anyone got one out there? Give me a shout.
Will do. And lastly, top three words you hope your kids would use to describe you as a dad. What do you hope that they would
Oh
be?
man, fun, kind, and fair. Those would be
Nice.
good. Yeah.
Great three words right there.
Yeah.
People, make sure you pick up all this book, but obviously pick up Bridge to Bat City. over at Hachette Book Group website. Of course, we'll put the links up here at artoffatherhood.net. But are you on social media? Tell the people if you are, you're not, or wherever. Where can people kind of interact with you?
Social media is bad for you. I would say sometimes you can't help. It's good for promoting your stuff, but I suggest you just promote your stuff and then you go away and don't look. I feel like it's bad for people artistically to be on social media, just because it'll feed your imposter syndrome and make you doubt yourself. You just have to go make your art and make what you want to make and put it out and try to not be attached to the results. And social media makes you attached to the results, but God bless all of you still on social media. 2024.
What a great way to go out on this podcast. Again, I appreciate you've been very generous with your time. Like you obviously know, I'm a big fan of your work, but I want to say thank you for sharing great insight on fatherhood. Thank you for making books that people can geek out to and just enjoy with their family. I wish you and your family continued success, but looking to see more, books from the, I know this book's going to do well, and I'd love to see you more in the children's group from you in the work that you're doing, sir. But thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, I had a blast talking with you. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. Thanks, as always, for checking out the Art of Fatherhood podcast. I really appreciate it. And I also appreciate Jim Morn over at Semper Smart Games for sponsoring this week's Art of Fatherhood podcast. They have a lot of great games. They have Election Night. They have math games. They have dice games. They have Blobby's Pizza. They have so many fun games. There's different ways that you and your family will have fun. For more information on them, go to SemperSmartGames.com or check them out on Amazon. They have a whole bunch of their games there as well. And while you're on the internet checking out Semper Smart Games, also please rate, subscribe, and review to the Art of Fatherhood podcast. I greatly appreciate it. And check out ArtofFatherhood.net for the latest articles, contests, giveaways, reviews, all the things that tie into fatherhood and family. You can check it out over at artoffatherhood.net. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and go to artoffatherhood.net.